The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. George Jacarel Omar is a professor of politics and global studies at Drexel University. He is the author of Recreated Chavez, A People's History of the Venezuelan Revolution, and he's also at the center of ongoing Twitter storms. On Christmas Eve of 2016, the professor tweeted, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." And in March of 2017, he tweeted that he had to hold back vomit when a soldier was given a first-class seat on a flight he was on. This was 2 days after the U.S. bombing of Mosul. In this week's episode, we discuss his tweets, academic freedom, and free speech. It's Thursday, July 13th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to remind you that Angela Nagle's book, Kill All Normies, is available through Amazon, and encourage you to ask your favorite bookstore or library to carry Zero Books titles. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. The Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. The music you're listening to right now is an instrumental cover of Green Day's American Idiot. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to George Zakir Omar and I discuss tweets and free speech. So, thanks for coming on. You've been kind of viral on social media and in the conventional media lately, really since the new year started. And you've been on the chopping block twice?
I think the first thing to say is that these kind of attacks have been a pretty constant feature of the past few years. They usually target women and people of color. And of course, you know, we know about the instability of adjunct labor and the ways in which these kind of controversies lead often to professors being quietly dismissed without it becoming really a big story. But I also think that we should recognize the ways in which these have become more intense around and after Trump's election, which of course really put the wind into the sails of the right in general, into a really hard fascist far right in particular. In both of my cases, the sectors that were attacking me and the response by Drexel University have been slightly different. The white genocide tweet targeted a particularly cherished myth of white nationalists and open overt racists. And as a result, the response and the threats that I got originated, I think, in more openly white supremacist groups. You know, you had this sort of spectrum between the Daily Stormer and Breitbart News. In the second case, though, when the question was really mainstream militarism, it was more crossover figures. It was Ann Coulter who really pushed my tweets into the Fox mainstream. And then, you know, Fox really wanted to milk it for all it was worth, and so put it at the top of their news cycle for a series of days.
And that was the one that kind of hurt you more, right? The second tweet, because it was picked up by the more mainstream outlets?
Yeah, it was picked up by Fox, and Fox pushed it and made it into, and blew it up into something that it wouldn't have been otherwise. I think what's common to these cases is the way in which, things that maybe weren't apparently going to be controversial are fabricated and manufactured into controversies. And the way that happens, I think, is really important for us to understand. In terms of different tacks in these different situations, the first tweet was denounced on the day after Christmas, as reprehensible. This statement was written by an unsigned, functionary of the communications department. University communications, which is problematic, I think, in a number of ways. The first, of course, is that it was bowing directly to pressure that was being created by Nazis, right, by Nazi groups. And when Drexel issued that first statement, the Daily Stormer, again, this openly anti-Semitic fascist website, claimed it as a victory. They said, this is proof that we can impact a university administration. It's also, I think, in a general sense, more, worrying because you've got questions of public relations dictating, statements by universities about the speech acts of faculty members. And then later, when Drexel even, issued a softer statement, it still missed really a good opportunity because, we're talking about a situation that has a lot of context that can be discussed. And even when the university sought to, soften its line, it could have, for example, pointed toward what white genocide refers to, what it means, the context of the speech, but instead simply made a sort of blanket statement about, the community norms of civility and the way that these were not reflected in this tweet. Now, the second tweet, interestingly, the statement by the university was very sort of boilerplate, less offensive in that sense, in the sense that it upheld, free speech and academic freedom. But quietly, it turned out, based on documents that were then released by Inside Higher Education, it turned out that I was put under investigation precisely because some donors had come forward and protested. And so here you've got a very worrying situation in which the simple fact that people are upset and threatening to withhold money can spur a university into a disciplinary action.
In the popular culture, I think someone might come along and look at your story and immediately think about a guy named John Ronson and the kind of a narrative about call-out culture in general. Like, do you think that what you faced is different in character than what a lot of other people have faced from sort of online Twitter call-outs, whether they're on the left or the right? I mean, there was a woman who was flying to – the one that John Ronson talks about is a woman was flying to Africa, and she made a tweet that was a joke. It meant to be kind of self-mocking joke, and it was taken the wrong way. And by the time her plane landed, I guess she was out of a job and really had become infamous. It was something like, I won't get AIDS in Africa because I'm white. Do you think that your white genocide tweet or the other tweet impacted you in any way because of this call-out culture? Was that part of what happened there?
It's interesting. That's a good question. And I wonder whether or not you can point toward a single culture. What I think is there's a clear tactic, and it's a tactic very much associated with Twitter, which is a new sort of mobbing, right? The way in which mobs are whipped up, directed in a certain direction, and unleashed. And this is something that that Milo Yiannopoulos, for example, is famous for. This is what he does. This is how he gained his following and his power, was during and around Gamergate, whipping up these sort of misogynistic and later racist mobs to attack people. And that's why he was eventually banned, from Twitter. So I think there's clearly a tactic. And this is a tactic that, of course, has become characteristic of our moment. It's what Trump himself does, not only through Twitter, but through other means. And it's become very dangerous and worrying. At the same time, I think it's difficult, and we need to, walk a fine line, because we also don't want to diminish what I think is the real power of, for example, Black Twitter, which has been very effective in pointing toward things that are troubling, that are problematic. In the parlance, the Twitter parlance, dragging people for making statements. And I think it's always and often a question of the content of these. I think there's a very easy liberalism that allows us to just drag people day in and day out for misstatements or for accurate statements, rather than, I think, grappling with what it takes to build kind of alternatives.
Okay, so I'm not sure I understood the last thing you said. Let me see if I can paraphrase it. So do you think that there's a liberal focus on kind of technical errors or things that when people make a misstatement or make a misstep, there's a sort of liberal tendency to zoom in on the mistake rather than to look, to take a step back and look at the larger context in which that tweet occurred in. Is that what you're saying?
I mean, that's part of it. I think it's also, however, I think it's this idea that, for example, if a celebrity says something offensive, that we're actually building an alternative politics by spending our time attacking that. I think the power is there. In these attempts to draw attention to, you know, underlying white supremacy, misogyny in popular culture. But we also need to understand what it would take to build real alternatives. In other words, to build popular movements and to build struggles around these questions that actually look, I think, below the words and look harder at what's going on in our society more broadly.
So are you saying that, like, if you focus too much on, say, something that a celebrity like, I don't know, Emma Watson said, and that might not be quite right, that you're missing the opportunity to build a politics that will change society rather than just calling out one individual? Or are you saying that a politics can be built around call-out culture that might push forward a new agenda and create a new politics?
Mm-hmm. I think it's a little both, for sure. Twitter, we shouldn't think that Twitter is a replacement for radical politics. But at the same time, when we're organizing in movements and in political organizations, pointing out and calling out, you know, certain behaviors or legacies or whether or not someone is sort of being subtly racist or sexist in an organizing space as well is crucial. And I think it's always, you know, there's always a balance to be struck. And I think it's actually in moments when there's not a lot of political mobilization that people really begin devouring one another with this kind of excessive call-out culture. And it undermines, I think, the work that we're trying to do.
Call him a mad vigilante. Call him a hero. Either way, he's always on target.
This was like the democratization of justice. Hierarchies were being leveled out. We were going to do things better. Soon after that, a disgraced pop science writer called Jonah Lehrer, he'd been caught plagiarizing and faking quotes, and he was drenched in shame and regret, he told me. And he had the opportunity to publicly apologize at a foundation lunch. This is going to be the most important speech of his life. Maybe it would win him some salvation. He knew before he arrived that the foundation was going to be live streaming his event. But what he didn't know until he turned up was that they'd erected a giant screen Twitter feed right next to his head. Another one in a monitor screen in his eyeline. You know, I don't think the foundation did this because they were monstrous. I think they were clueless. I think this was a unique moment when the beautiful naivety of Twitter was hitting the increasingly horrific reality. And here were some of the tweets that were cascading into his eyeline as he was trying to apologize. Jonah Lehrer boring us into forgiving him. And Jonah Lehrer has not proven that he is capable of feeling shame. That one must have been written by the best psychiatrist ever to know that about such a tiny figure behind a lectern. And Jonah Lehrer is just a frigging sociopath. That last word is a very human thing to do, to dehumanize the people we hurt. It's because we want to destroy people but not feel bad about it. Imagine if this was an actual court and the accused was in the dock begging for another chance and the jury was yelling out, "Bored! Sociopath!" You know, when we watch courtroom dramas, we tend to identify with the kind-hearted defense attorney. But give us the power, and we become like hanging judges. Power shifts fast. We were getting Jonah because he was perceived to have misused his privilege. But Jonah was on the floor then, and we were still kicking and congratulating ourselves for punching up.
So let's talk about the tweets particularly, just to, you know, in case anyone's missed it. Your tweet about white genocide was a bit of dark satire. There's a concept on the reactionary right, in the racist right, the race realist right, that thinks that demographic changes in Europe or the United States is equivalent to white genocide. And So, but I'm just asking, can you explain what your tweet meant in that context?
Sure. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The white genocide is this kind of paranoid fantasy of the racist right. It was developed and really popularized by David Lane, who was also the one who coined the famous 14 words, a white supremacist slogan that says, we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And, you know, incidentally or not incidentally, Ann Coulter recently provoked a controversy simply by tweeting 14 exclamation point, which many took to be a direct reference to these 14 words. What's peculiar, I think, about the white genocide theory and in particular about the response to my tweet, you know, my tweet said that I wanted white genocide for Christmas, is that even those who believe in it, and particularly those who believe in this paranoid conspiracy of white genocide, they define it to mean intermarriage, diversity politics, even low birth rates among whites. In other words, it doesn't mean the mass killing of white people at all. And yet those were the same people who stoked the controversy. They knew what it meant, and they used it nevertheless as almost like an empty signifier that they could use to bridge into the mainstream media by arguing that I was actually calling for the slaughter, the wholesale slaughter of white people. And in fact, the tweet was a response to what you may have seen, an outcry from racists to a State Farm ad which showed a black man proposing to a white woman, in which people tweeted back and said, I can't believe State Farm is supporting white genocide. And if that, you know, I mean, so I think we should be clear, if that is what white genocide means, then we're all for it. I mean, this is, you know, something we should all be embracing. But if it means the subjugation, victimization, destruction, or slaughter of white people, this is an absurd fantasy that's never had any reality in a country that's still dominated, of course, and controlled by mostly white people.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, and that's the whole reason that the term white genocide was coined, is so that there could be a confusion sowed about, you know, what they were talking about. So it would have more power by making that kind of association with real violence and you know, actual genocide. Although, you know, if you look up the definition of genocide that the UN uses, there are arguments about, you know, displacement and things that maybe somebody might make. I don't think that they're valid, but genocide doesn't only mean directly slaughtering people. If you push people out of their land, that's another kind of genocide.
Absolutely. And what they want, the far right, the radical right, has spent years trying to sneak their concepts into the mainstream with a kind of Trojan horse strategy. And I actually think people have argued rightly that white genocide is the key Trojan horse that they're using to soften their own white nationalism. They don't have to say we're for, you know, white power and white nationalism. They can simply say we're against this genocide. And if we want to get deeper into it, I mean, we would get to the point where we realize that whiteness is not a thing, right? You know, it's not nothing to be genocided in the way that other groups maybe could, because it's a political construct that's established out of a whole sort of a package of privileges that different people at different times have enjoyed. You know, Italians and Irish, you know, being more recently admitted into the club, and so, you know, the idea that it could be genocided is a curious one.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and it's something I sometimes emphasize on the podcast, or I've talked about it before. I first came across this idea that whiteness wasn't really even a thing. It wasn't even a race. In a journal called Race Traitor, you know,
absolutely,
ironically enough. And it was saying, you know, treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity. Right. And, you know, I read that and I thought, you know, there's definitely truth to this. That the problem with whiteness as a concept is it was born out. It brought a lot of people who didn't have a common ethnic identity together under a category of superiority in the context of the birth of slavery, and in order as a backwards kind of justification for what was really just a economic move and a horribly unjust, you know, horrible atrocity, but that was the birth of whiteness, you know, was the beginning of slavery. However, it seemed to me that one of the other consequences, if you abolish whiteness, is that along with it, there goes the concept of blackness as well. That blackness is no real ethnic identity either.
Absolutely. Yeah. At the same time, I think blackness is absolutely a political category in the same way that whiteness is. In other words, neither have a biological reality, but they both enjoy a social reality. I think the point is to understand that the social reality that they enjoy is very different. You know, one, of course, is its social reality is a package of privileges. And I think privileges precisely actually to follow on from Race Trader and some of my own comrades who were editors of Race Trader, the idea that a package of privileges is something to be abolished. You know, we don't say, let's negotiate with and discuss and analyze the monarchy or the feudal order. We say, no, these are privileges to be abolished. Blackness is different in the sense that while still a political identity, it's an identity that's established in, you know, on the one hand, in oppression, structural oppression, and on the other hand, in resistance. And it gains, I think, a certain level of, not reality, no more than political reality, but a certain level of autonomy in that sense. And that, as we see with sort of black power movements, people beginning to identify with that history and with that struggle of resistance. It's always complicated because it's in conversation with these questions of sort of Africanness and other things. But it gains, I think, a different political valence, even if it still is a certain kind of political fiction.
Yeah, it's hard because the same thing happens with the working class. I mean, I come from, I'm a kind of a wannabe Marxist, right? So the real task of the working class is to abolish itself as a class, right?
Absolutely.
And that would be the real task of black liberation as well. You would see the disappearance of the category of blackness after black liberation because, you know, without white supremacy, there is no black category either, right? But in the here and now, you can't pretend like there is no working class is no politics, right? That's not helpful at all. So we can't pretend like we've achieved the goal that we're aiming at. It's not just a matter of how we talk or how we even think about this. There's got to be a political and economic and social change.
Absolutely. And if anything, it's the opposite. It's the opposite in the present, which is that there are too few people identifying as working class. In other words, people who are poor, people who are exploited, who live under a certain class condition, who nevertheless consider themselves to be sort of, temporarily embarrassed middle class, members of the middle class. And they refuse that identity. And that's precisely something that has to be built and deepened.
Yeah. This is true. I think that's a step. The problem is that I find that I think that there's a tendency towards workerism on the left, where you become quite comfortable in your position as identifying with a working class culture without ever understanding or taking the steps to understand just what it would take to eliminate the working class, and to think of it. Think of being working class primarily as a cultural identity leaves out the whole, relationship to the means of production and exploitation and all of that stuff that Marx talks about. So, and I feel maybe, and I'm not in any way qualified to talk about this in terms of race, but I wonder if something similar is the case when it comes to race, that that along with it, no one needs to be. Look, and when it comes to black identity, that's not something that you have to realize, or that's something that comes to you right away. But there's a book called Racecraft, and I forget the author's name, but she tends to argue that one of the things that black liberation politics needs to do is understand that they're going to lose the concept of race along the way. So I'll just stop there and let you respond to that.
Yeah, I think so. Racecraft by the Fields sisters is a key intervention, I think, into this question. At the same time, I think there's a tendency to neglect the ways in which these categories need to be mobilized and pushed forward. I think the concept of Racecraft is to imply, the point of it is to imply that everyone who talks about race or uses race as a category of analysis is participating in a fiction and as a result upholding that fiction. When I think there's a long trajectory, an undeniable trajectory of people who mobilize and have mobilized a political understanding of race without claiming that this to be a kind of biological reality. And they do so precisely to abolish that category, as you put it. You know, people through Fanon and, you know, and Malcolm X in the United States and the Black Panther Party, who had an understanding of the material reality of the social construction that is race, who were not tempted to cease to speak about it, but always put it into what I understand to be a dialectical view that puts it, sets it into motion toward its ultimate abolition. Now, I think it's very difficult to foresee when and how that abolition happens. I think it happens alongside the abolition of capitalism as a mode of production and, you know, the colonial legacies of our world. So we're talking about a long-term process. But I think there's always been a different trajectory within that uses and mobilizes race as a political concept. This is the race trader trajectory that sees the wages of whiteness, for example, as intervening powerfully in the history of the United States.
Well, let's talk about your second tweet about the U.S. serviceman who was given a first-class seat on a plane and what inspired that tweet.
Sure. So that second tweet was a sort of off-the-cuff tweet that wasn't actually about the soldier at all, who I didn't even see. Although I understand, I guess, in retrospect, that wasn't completely clear. I was actually responding to the spectacle of the heroic rich passenger returning to coach to collect praise for having given up his seat. Not only was that a display of what I took to be militaristic culture that I found kind of stomach churning given the incineration of hundreds in most just the day before, but it also, I think, reflected a deep-seated, what I take to be a deep-seated disdain for the thousands of poor Americans who join the military because they don't have other good options, because they don't have access to, you know, to education, or even those who join voluntarily but are offered really only this barest of symbolic support. As one family member and Marine Corps veteran put it to me recently, he said, every time someone told him thank you for your service, all he could hear was better you than me.
Were you traveling alone when you made that? You know, it seemed to me that what you tweeted was sort of the kind of thing you might turn to your friend on the plane and say. You know, like it would be the beginning of a conversation. It was an emotional reaction. You turn to your friend and say, I can't believe this shit. Why, you know, it makes me want to vomit. Something like that, right? And then your friend would say, what do you mean? And then you talk about it. And in the context of a moment, maybe you come to some understanding, and that would be it. But instead, we live in a world where traveling alone, you tweeted something that no one else who read it could really understand because they weren't there, right? And so now you have this emotional response coming from you into the Twitter universe, and it's being picked apart in a million different ways. Do you feel like maybe one trick to avoiding these kinds of problems in the future is to realize that Twitter is not the friend next to you on the plane, but as a publishing platform?
I mean, I think it's interesting the way you described it, because you said you would turn and you would begin a conversation. And I actually think, we've had some really interesting and productive conversations. I think conversations aren't always fun or comfortable, and I certainly would rather they didn't have as many death threats as they, you know, involved for me. Well, for example, I think it's no small thing that the hashtag white genocide was a top trend on Twitter, that people in the mainstream were discussing the concept, picking it apart, you know, dismissing it as the fiction that it is. And I think when it comes to this question of the military, it's a similar thing. What really concerns me, though, is not, you know, it's the question, I think, is constantly debatable. What's useful? What isn't? What's productive? What isn't? I think the real question is, at what point do we begin to not speak because we're worried about the consequences, right? At what point do we not begin to have these things, which maybe are provocative, which maybe are meant to provoke longer conversations, but instead we back off? And I find myself feeling that way, right? Because it's like when you touch a stove, you don't want to continue to burn yourself. And the real brutal reaction to some of these tweets is maybe second guess, a lot of things that I think are totally valid conversations to begin and to provoke and to start having. And so what worries me, I think, is when we suggest that, you know, that we shouldn't be beginning these and shouldn't be too provocative. And I actually think it's you know, as we've seen in of course, previous Twitter controversies, but also more recently this week, a colleague of mine, Tommy Curry at Texas A&M, he's under attack and he's receiving racist death threats for a podcast he did 5 years ago. And it wasn't a tweet. It was a long, thought-out conversation, which was nevertheless picked apart and nevertheless dissected and sort of put into this kind of bite-sized media, you know, sort of media messaging in a way that has led to the same consequences. So I'm also wary, I guess, of the idea that Twitter is peculiar and that our enemies won't use any means, I think, to attack us.
Well, okay. So I think I see your point. I want to shift over to a part of this interview that will be a little more critical. But before I do that, I want to ask you this. How can people who support your academic freedom help? Because I definitely think that not only are your tweets being misrepresented and not only are you being unfairly attacked, but also, you know, you just have the right to political speech and that you should not face this kind of you shouldn't risk losing your job when you speak out on politics. So what do you think people could do to help you the most right now?
I think at this point, it's not clear what's going on with my case. I may be under investigation. I may not be. I may lose my job. I may not, although I think it's probably unlikely. But I think the bigger thing, honestly, is to be able to prepare to mount these kind of defenses for everyone. In other words, these, you know, again, we're talking about attacks that have been carried on many people. Stephen Salaita, of course, black women like Saida Grundy and Zandria Robinson have come under similar attack and have been similarly kind of thrown under the bus by universities. Tommy Curry most recently. This is going to continue. And so what I think, you know, we need to do is to prepare to make a not just a tepid, abstract response, I think, and this will get into, I think, some of the discussion we're going to have now. But, you know, I think there's a tendency to say, oh, I support this person's free speech and they're being dumb and they're being ridiculous and absurd, but I still support it. And I actually think this is a kind of mealy-mouthed liberal defense that nevertheless hands a lot of weapons over to our enemies, because it flees, I think, from the responsibility of trying to understand the stakes of what's going on in the world and what kind of battles that we're going to have. And I think this, in some ways, is the, you know, the upshot of suggesting that maybe that people should stop tweeting or suggest that people should not be so provocative, because these things are going to really just put wind into the sails of the right, and in particular, the right's attempts to intervene on campus.
I agree with a lot of what you just said, except I do wonder about the need to defend free speech, maybe in the abstract. So let's talk about that. Some people would criticize you, like when you were on Tucker Carlson. He made about a lot of hay out of the fact that, for instance, when Charles Murray was going to appear at a university, you took to Twitter calling for people to stop him from speaking, and basically called you a hypocrite for that. How is that action different from the kinds of actions people are taking against you in retaliation for your tweets?
To be clear, I think we should be clear from the outset that my case has never been solely about free speech. I've never framed it in that way, although that's certainly a component of what's going on. And while free speech is crucial, I've also then positioned myself pretty clearly against what I understand is a free speech absolutist position, in which we, in my view, we spend more time protecting the free speech of our enemies who would like to have us killed than putting forward a substantive radical agenda of our own. The right doesn't give a shit if we're consistent in defending all speech, and they're not known for their principled moral consistency. And moreover, we simply can't build a left worthy of the name if we're spending our time upholding the rights of Nazis and fascists and racists and transphobic harassers like Milo Yiannopoulos to build their movements right under our noses. And I think what we're saying is that we care more about abstract principles than the concrete existence of those who are on our side and the people that these people are actively threatening. And then I think we run into a dangerous absurdity of seeing everything as a free speech issue. I mean, free speech as a question, I think, suffuses a lot of these things. But for example, the First Amendment doesn't guarantee Milo or Charles Murray the right to a university platform to kind of spout their garbage. Murray knows this perfectly well, which is why his entire career has been built on money from right-wing think tanks who pay for him to write and pay for him to publish his racist books and then even paid journalists to read the bell curve to sort of spread the gospel. And so I think if we make this into a fight about abstract principles, I think one of the things that we miss are the real material interventions that the right is making. And we undermine our own ability to mount a material counterattack in defense of bodies and lives. The First Amendment isn't what guarantees me a space on campus either. I've been lucky enough to be hired, and accepted norms of academic freedom mean that I can still enjoy First Amendment rights off campus and the right to be outspoken and critical on campus. But as I've said elsewhere, I think free speech and academic freedom are shields that we need, but we also need swords to move forward and to push back an aggressive right that's actively using free speech and using it in bad faith to manufacture controversies on campus and beyond.
Look, when it comes to Charles Murray, I mean, there are lots of different arguments about whether or not it's a good idea to shut him down, right? You know, we could have a tactical debate about whether it was smart to attack Milo the way that people did, or whether, you know, letting him have enough rope to hang himself would have been a better approach. But let's put that aside, because I think it's really important to talk about just the idea of academic freedom and free speech and why it's important. And not that I have written down in front of me a very clear line on it. But I do kind of feel like I lean towards this kind of absolutist position where in a society, when you're not at war, when you're actually not at the level of violence, that it's a good idea to allow people to speak regardless of the content of their speech. And I had a guy on named Norman Finkelstein who calls himself a free speech absolutist in the mold of J.S. Mill, John Stuart Mill, and he says that even the worst ideas, say, for instance, the idea that the world is flat, should be allowed to be presented and debated because it is only through debate, even with such ideas, that we test our understanding, and that to suppress speech because it is wrong or absurd or racist amounts to suppression based on authority. Because we can't know in advance that something is wrong, but have to determine that rightness or wrongness through debate and discussion, unless, you know, we're no longer trying to determine rightness or wrongness of ideas, but are acting out in a violent way, which sometimes is justifiable. But what do you make of that position?
I mean, I think it's interesting that you said unless we're at war, because I mean, I think we are at war, but maybe that's a longer conversation to have. You know, we're talking about people's bodies and existence being on the line every day. But I also think that historically, it's just not the case that good ideas defeat bad ideas. I think this is kind of almost a quasi-religious attachment that we have to reason and rationality, and yet nothing, I think, could be more irrational than thinking our world is rational, that it functions rationally. And I actually find the worst ideas, in particular white supremacy, are kind of consciously structured unreason. You can't convince a racist that they're behaving irrationally because their decision to be a racist wasn't undertaken for rational reasons to begin with. And historically speaking, I think Nazism wasn't defeated by argument. Fascism wasn't defeated by argument. And slavery in the U.S. in particular wasn't defeated by argument. Precisely because in here, you know, kind of referring to the words of my late comrade Joel Olson, one of the editors of Race Traitor, actually, you can't argue with a slave master. It's not only the case that we shouldn't try to argue and legitimize the ideas of some of these people, like Richard Spencer, who speaks of peaceful ethnic cleansing, for example. But I think we're fooling ourselves if we think that we could, because as you know, as Jean-Paul Sartre put it when describing anti-Semitism, you know, the anti-Semite is as solid as a stone. They're impervious to any kind of reason.
I definitely agree with you that it's not the case that the best ideas always win out. However, part of the project of being on the left is to try to create conditions where the best ideas can win out, where there's enough freedom for people to be able to express themselves without being shut down by authoritarian violence, and for there to be a testing of ideas and understanding in a state of basic friendship and mutual respect. And then that's not, you know, the world we live in, but there are pockets of it, right? And within the United States, for instance, while we're terrible against our, domestic, foreign enemies, there at least is a tradition of in the state, not at work, and not in every part of our private life, but in certain institutions, of creating a relative realm of equality. So when you go into a and stop Murray from appearing there, you're basically saying, yeah, this space isn't a relative realm of equality. The only solution is to use violence to stop bad ideas, because we have no respect or faith in this institution as a space for relative equality.
I actually think when you shut down someone like Murray or Milo Yiannopoulos, I think you're saying in some ways the opposite. In other words, you're not saying this is not a space for dialogue and discussion and respectful debate. What you're saying is that I reject the boundaries that these people are preemptively a priori putting on that. You know, there's a really good argument that was made recently about these things. It says, listen, when you believe that certain people are inferior, what you're also saying is that they are not qualified to participate in discussion, right? And this is the question of slavery writ large. In other words, making other people into objects who cannot debate and discuss. And so,
but you know, it's not though, because I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's not the story of slavery writ large, because no one argued anyone onto those slave ships. You know, it wasn't like they went and made a case that these people were inferior.
That's exactly right.
So when you allow them to make the case, you're in a space where that case can be debated, if it is the case of, hey, you're inferior and should step onto the slave ship, that in that space, it's not going to win the day. I mean, that's just, but it's only through violence that slavery could have occurred. It would never have happened if, you had to debate the Africans onto the ships.
Right. And it was only through violence that it could be abolished. But precisely for the same reasons I think we're talking about today. In other words, when people are systematically disqualified from it's not that people can't speak out against Charles Murray. It's that when, as you put it, pockets of spaces for debate. And the goal is precisely to make those pockets bigger. But you make them bigger, I think, in part by recognizing that people who want to shut down Murray and Milo, are using their own free expression and are putting themselves in the streets and saying, this is so important to me. My equality is so important to me. My ability to speak and intervene in these debates is so important to me that it's worth it. And I think we can see this as well, speaking in about the ways in which, for example, Black Lives Matter has, I think, radically transformed this country, not through ideas and arguments alone, or even primarily, I don't think, but actually through the insistence of saying Black Lives Matter is not an argument, right? You're actually making a kind of symbolic intervention to reflect, a disconnect with reality. But also you're rebelling dramatically in Ferguson, in Baltimore, and elsewhere, and you're creating a situation in which those who are disqualified by people like Charles Murray, who's seen as inferior by people like Richard Spencer, are kind of standing up and doing the most human thing possible, which is to resist and to fight. And I think seeing people fight historically, whether it's in the Civil War or today, is part of what transforms our debates, opens up spaces for dialogue, and really creates a really kind of productive political situation, which is like the one that we've got these days.
The reason a movement like Black Lives Matter can make can have such a lasting effect and arrive on the scene and change the way we're thinking or change the politics of our time to the extent that it did is precisely because, there is the sense that people have the right to speak even when you disagree with them strongly, and that there's a realm for a moral argument. Not that, this was technically an argument, but it was an assertion which our own values have to make us accept. I mean, as liberals, right, as people in America, the this is to say anything but, yeah, Black Lives Matter is to not just be racist, but it doesn't compute. So, yeah, it was the right thing to say, and it was said in a country where, as bad as it is, there was at least this kind of, in civil society, the sense that, yeah, people have the right to speak out. People have the right to their dissent. And without that sense, if we lose that along the way, we're going to be in real trouble.
Sure. I mean, it's not to say that ideas don't matter. I think the question is always, you know, when and how, to paraphrase Marx, these ideas grip and are gripped by the masses. Because you could say precisely the same thing of pre-Civil War United States, where there was a certain amount of debate and a certain amount of moral appeal by abolitionists, and yet it was in many ways the rebellions of slaves themselves who were not allowed to participate in these debates. And it was also the, you know, the violent intervention of you know, John Brown and others at Harper's Ferry that provoked and opened a space for not only conversation, you know, but for the defeat of slavery.
Yeah, but the slave rebellions weren't stopping people from debate. That's all I'll say, and then we'll move on. Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about your appearance on Tucker Carlson, because he irritated me profoundly. I bet you I was not alone. There's this moment where he did this typical right-wing move of claiming that, you know, anti-intellectual move of taking a college professor's work and reading it as if it was gibberish. And so he read your work and acted as if it was unclear and obscure and illiterate. And look, one of my jobs is I read manuscripts from college professors, right? And I'm not a college professor, but I read these theoretical works. And sometimes there's some truth to the fact that people hide behind jargon and unclear prose because their ideas aren't very clear. That is not the case with what he read. So what did he read, and what did it say, and what did you think of that whole part of that interview?
Sure. I think what was most amazing about, you know, Tucker's faux incomprehension is that while he was trying to prove something about academic writing, his interns maybe accidentally just randomly plucked out a passage that, besides being a decade old, was written for a non-academic socialist journal, The Monthly Review. It was not an academic piece. And you know, as you put it, it was really not that hard to understand if you would just read it. It's about dual power in Venezuela. And I think dual power for me is really a linchpin for thinking not only about the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, its challenges, its tensions, its contradictions, but also about revolutionary change more general. You know, and more generally, dual power comes out of Lenin's writings between the two 1917 revolutions. It refers to the emergence from below of new and alternative grassroots power structures against the existing power of the bourgeois state. And through this lens, worked through understanding contemporary Venezuela, and certain things became clear. For example, that this alternative grassroots power had been emerging since long before Chavez, and indeed, in the words of in the title of my first book, created Chavez, that this power was the source of revolutionary energy in the Bolivarian process, which is never simply about populism or an individual caudillo, and that the inherent clash between this alternative power from below in the state, whether the Chavista state or opposition governed state, would be a kind of permanent feature of the Bolivarian Revolution until it was resolved in one direction or the other. And today, in my more recent book on Venezuela, Building the Commune, I argue this alternative power is really represented by the communes, which are very much on a back foot today, which are struggling against not only Chavismo, elements of Chavismo, but also with the opposition and with the underlying structure of the Venezuelan economy, and clashes directly with the state, while simultaneously representing, I think, the future of any revolutionary hope in Venezuela.
Anything like dual power could occur in the United States? Is there a dual power approach that wouldn't require taking the state to start with?
Absolutely. And I think, so I came across the concept of dual power, not in theory, but in practical organizing, when I was a member of a revolutionary organization called Bring the Ruckus, founded by people who came out of the Race Trader Journal as well, but which explicitly upheld what we call the dual power strategy. And this was a strategy that involved simultaneously building alternatives while fighting the existing system, understanding that, in fact, we fight best when we're building autonomous spaces and alternatives. And in a way, it was a way of splitting the difference between the prefigurative build an alternative world politics that many associate with a certain kind of anarchism and the frontal kind of attack on the system of a kind of Leninist approach. I think it's hard to overstate how important this is for organizing in the present. The strength of the Occupy movement, for example, like that of the communes of Venezuela, has been taking over space and building antagonistic alternatives and to try to build a new kind of community while fighting against the existing world. in the U.S. context, in organizing against the police, which is where most of my organizing has happened, whether it's in Oakland after Oscar Grant was killed or in Philadelphia more recently, this means building alternatives to the police in the form of neighborhood, you know, rapid response and self-defense networks that make it possible for people to imagine and begin to build a different kind of world. And I think in the present moment, Trump's own kind of aggressive racism has helped us to solidify the connections between the domestic, you know, policing of populations and migration enforcement. We should bear in mind that both the Fraternal Order of Police and ICE endorsed Trump. So, you know, making this connection, you know, very palpably clear. And so while my own organization was involved in building alternatives to policing, we're also involved then simultaneously in supporting direct community-based resistance to ICE raids in Arizona in particular. And I think it's at the intersection of these two struggles, black and brown, united in the development of an alternative power. In other words, developing the power of communities to resist and take care of themselves and defend themselves. It's there, I think, that we're going to see the most important struggles of the coming years unfolding.
Okay, one last question on just a free speech issue, and which is, do you think that the left should struggle for free speech, basically for ideas that are revolutionary and that are humane and good, and that we should be willing to shut down the speech that is from our enemies and that is bad? Or do you have a more complex view? I just want to kind of underscore this part of the conversation.
I mean, I think speech, it needs to be understood as a constantly contested terrain. It's never been free, and it's never going to be free. It's always a terrain over which people are struggling for access to, for example, media outlets or access to spaces or access to audiences. And so, in other words, we need to think about it more in terms of something like what Gramsci would call a struggle for hegemony, building different ideas, getting them out, but understanding that those ideas will be resisted and that we don't have the simple freedom, to put them out there. At the same time, I think that there are if we're talking about this question of free speech and how to engage with, a country in which free speech is relatively less limited than others. There are places where it's illegal to engage in certain kinds of speech. In fact, everywhere it's illegal to engage in certain kinds of speech. But how to engage these questions, I think we need to fall back in certain ways on strategic questions of what it would take to build revolutionary movements and to build a strong left. And I think this involves, first and foremost, drawing hard lines about who believes that, you know, that people are equal and who believes that they are fundamentally or biologically unequal. And I don't think that's a very hard line to draw, because I think it calls in, as I put it before, it calls into question the existence of people that are part of our movements, that are part of the left. And I think those people in particular, but everyone who cares, will use their speech in an attempt to counter and shut that speech, that kind of speech down, because it's speech that also simultaneously produces and encourages harm, encourages danger, and encourages the emergence of the kind of movements that we need to be fighting today.
Do you think there's should be at least the enough freedom to speak and debate, and on the left, that we should continue having conversations like this one, where we ask the question, like, what would happen if someone debated Richard Spencer? Or do you think that someone on the left who debated Richard Spencer should just be themselves no platformed in the future?
No, I think I think that's exactly a strategic question to be undertaken. I have a pretty clear opinion on whether or not it's useful to debate Richard Spencer. I think he was debated pretty effectively with a fist in the face. And I think we should understand that that was a radically political act that, you know, despite all of the crowing about it being counterproductive, generated vast discussions that entered the mainstream of our national debate. And so it was incredibly useful. But I think we need to have those strategic discussions on the left. And they do often occur on the strategic level. The kind of conversation we're obviously not going to have on the left is about whether or not, you know, certain populations are inferior, right? Are unequal or are sort of semi-human. And these are, you know, and that's why I say it's, on the one hand, I don't think speech is under any kind of threat in the United States. I think the left needs to think very hard about how it is that we engage these questions. And I think we need to think strategically about, you know, how we, you know, consolidate a broader movement capable of fighting.
Let me tell you one last thing, and then I want to give you an opportunity to like ask yourself a question or talk about something I haven't given you an opportunity to talk about. But I recently was invited onto a podcast in response to Sam Harris interviewing Charles Murray. Yeah, you probably know who Sam Harris is. And I had listened to that Sam Harris podcast, and I just was so depressed by it because, you know, Sam Harris, of course, was not only was he giving Charles Murray a platform, which I wouldn't necessarily say he shouldn't do, but he was so soft and was just really, he helped Murray out a lot. And I knew that there were people who might even be, you know, mostly young white guys, but might be considering themselves part of the left, who were going to listen to Sam Harris, who they didn't know or understand to be not part of the left, and think to themselves, well, maybe this race realist stuff isn't, you know, that racist. It's just science or whatever they were going to think. So I had an opportunity to go onto a podcast that sort of would speak to part of that that audience, a smaller podcast. But I worried. I worried because – not because I was afraid of the right, this reaction, but because I worried that even to stand up and try to criticize Charles Murray was a risk for me, because if I did it incorrectly, that I could face a lot of blowback from my own side. To stand up in public and just debate Murray's ideas with even with someone else might be – I thought that was a risky move. Do you think I was over like being paranoid about that, or?
No, I mean, I think the stakes of this are so high, right? And I think that's part of what we're struggling with. But I think the example you gave is a really good example of the limits of this speech narrative. In other words, and Bill Maher did something similar, right? He said, "Oh, I'll have Milo on." He was criticized for having Milo on and said, "Oh no, I'm going to show how ridiculous he was." And in the end, he ended up sort of fawning over Milo and giving him, soft peddling his transphobia and encouraging all of these things. For example, Bill Maher wants to have me on, and I'm similarly torn in the way that you were torn about, whether or not we know platform people who are engaging in this kind of almost encouraging and enabling of white supremacy. But precisely the danger is what you pointed towards. In other words, the way in which that what is described to us as a discussion in a debate is actually a way to soften and make palatable and whitewash these ideas for a mainstream audience. And that's what Charles Murray professionally does. This is literally what his entire job description essentially is. In other words, to take pseudoscientific arguments and inject them into the mainstream and into policy circles so that you have people in the 90s, even in the Democratic Party, turning to Charles Murray to help to explain why they need to lock up, hundreds of thousands of more people with the new crime bill. And so these things are, again, not without consequence. And I think the speech argument, while useful, often helps to obscure the real material reality of what's going on, which is the slow infiltration of really brutally racist ideas into the mainstream.
I agree. But I feel like in that case, if I hadn't gone on to debate Murray, then the only voice this particular audience would have heard would have been the Sam Harris side of the debate. I mean, like, we can't stop Sam Harris from going on or having Murray on. I mean, I wouldn't have Murray on my podcast, right? I might have Richard Spencer on, but I probably won't. But the reason to do that would be because he's so bad, and to debate him would lay it so clearly out that I don't feel like the risk that I would be helping him would be that high. Yeah, but Murray is a different kettle of fish, and he's very good. Like, one of the problems I had with this being on this other podcast was I really wanted to say, look, Murray is pushing an anti-Semitic narrative. You have to understand that this whole story he's telling about the white working class and how the cognitive elite are causing these problems for the white working class. That cognitive elite it's not that it's a dog whistle even. It's just, it's a stand-in for or leads you to this blaming of the Jews eventually. And, it fits in with this Nazi narrative. What Murray's saying meshes very well. It's a whitewashed version of a Nazi narrative. And, you know, I've heard it before from outright anti-Semites. So I wanted to say that, but I didn't end up saying it because I felt like I had to take baby steps to that. I can't just lay down the truth. You know, I had to have a longer dialogue before I could get to there, and I didn't have the time to get there. But I feel like if we just retreat from conversation and debate, or if we are seen as being anti-freedom and because or anti-speech, that we're really going to lose out to guys like Murray, that we're really going to lose hold of the cultural and political moment. And so I guess I've said my piece there.
No, I don't disagree. I think we need to fight these ideas. I think the question is how we fight them, what kind of platforms we have to fight them. And that's why I think often it's necessary to, you know, to engage with with mainstream outlets that are antagonistic to us. It's often necessary to use whatever leverage we've got to fight against these ideas. And I think there are ways to do that that don't co-sign those ideas, that don't treat them as reasonable, precisely because what the goal is to, exactly as you put, to show the ways in which these function, right? The sort of the nuanced function of these whitewashed ideas that smuggle in this Trojan horse fashion, smuggle white supremacy into mainstream discourse, sanitize it, make it something that young kind of, you know, white voters are going to pick up and echo, often without even realizing it. And this is the broad narrative of white victimization over the past 40 years, is creating an idea, very successfully establishing the idea that white people are victims, right? And that is far more widespread than white supremacist organizations, right? This is a predominant narrative in certain communities. And it's got incredibly powerful effects, which I think we're seeing play out all over. Pointing out those connections and pointing out this spectrum that's being established between the far right and the soft right, these are crucial interventions that we need to make. And the question is always really a strategic one.